64. Gwendy sits cross-legged on the bed, wet hair wrapped in a towel, and hits send on the email she just finished writing. Once the modem disconnects from dial-up, she closes her laptop. A look of concern on her face, she swings her legs off the bed and starts to get dressed. She's tying her shoes when the phone rings. Hello, trying not to get her hopes up.
Gwendy, it's Patsy Follett. I catch you at a bad time.
Patsy, she says, excited to hear the congresswoman's voice. I just responded to your email.
And I just opened it and read it. Figured it'd be easier to call.
Well, how are you? Gwendy asks. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
I was doing great until I talked to my friend in the Senate this morning. Then not so great. You think we're going to be called back early?
That's what he said. Some kind of emergency session because of President Big Mouth and Korea. First time it's happened since Harry Flippin' Truman.
That means there's more going on behind the scenes than the news is telling us.
Evidently,
Patsy says with disgust in her voice. I gotta admit, this is the first time I've actually been scared the idiot's gonna get us in another war. Gwendy looks across the bedroom at the button box on the dresser. She walks over to it.
I lose you, Gwen?
No, I'm right here, just thinking. 65. Gwendy only stays at her parents' house for a short time that afternoon, just long enough to talk Patriots football with her dad. He thinks Pete Carroll has to go after another fourth-place finish. She believes he deserves one more year to turn things around and help her mom pick out an outfit for the New Year's Eve dinner later that night at the Goffs. She's already outside on the front porch, digging in her coat pockets for her car keys, when Mrs. Peterson swings open the door and stops her.
Hold on a second. I need to talk to you about something.
Gwendy turns around.
You need to get back inside, Mom, before you catch cold. It's freezing out here.
This'll only take a second. It's bad news, Gwendy thinks, reading the expression on her face.
I knew it was too good to be true.
I'm afraid I have some bad news.
Oh, Mom, Gwendy says, what is it?
I should have told you before now, but I kept chickening out.
Gwendy goes to her. Just tell me what's wrong. I've checked my bag. I've looked everywhere. I even called the hospital. But I can't find your magic feather anywhere.
Gwendy stares at her and starts laughing.
What? Mrs. Peterson asks. What's so funny?
I thought you were going to tell me you were sick again, that the hospital had made another mistake. Mrs. Peterson places a hand over her heart.
Dear God, no.
The feather will turn up if it's supposed to, Gwendy says, opening the door. It did once before. Now get inside, you silly woman. 66. On her way home from Carbine Street, Gwendy sees Sheriff Ridgwick's cruiser parked on the shoulder of Route 117 with its hazard lights blinking. She hits her turn signal and pulls over behind him. As she gets out of the car, she spots the sheriff climbing out of a snowy ravine that runs alongside the highway. He's up to his hips in drifting snow and cussing up a blue streak.
What would your constituents think if they heard you talking like that?
The sheriff looks up at her with snow in his hair and daggers in his eyes.
They'd think I've had a shitty-ass day, which I have.
Gwendy extends a hand to help.
What were you doing down there, anyway?
Thought I saw something, he says, taking her hand.
He pops out of the ditch and starts stomping his boots on the gravel shoulder. He looks up at her.
I was just about to call you before I pulled over.
What's up? He rubs a hand over his chin.
We received a padded envelope at the station house about an hour ago. No return address. Postmarked yesterday in Augusta.
Gwendy feels her face flush.
She knows what's coming next.
The orange ski hat that Deborah Parker was wearing the afternoon she went ice skating was inside the envelope. And stuffed inside the hat, three more teeth, presumably hers.
Gwendy gapes at him, unable to find the words.
To make matters worse, I just got off the phone a little while ago with that reporter from the Portland Herald. Someone leaked. He knows about the teeth we found in the sweatshirt, and he knows about the package.
But you said it was only delivered an hour ago. He nods. That's right.
So how...
Sheriff Ridgwick shrugs.
Somebody needed the money, I guess. Anyway, he's working on an article for tomorrow morning's paper, and he's already calling the guy the Tooth Fairy.
Jesus.
Oh, yeah, he says grimly. Shit's about to hit the fan.
Gwendy's brief speech at the PTA New Year's Eve party goes over well and earns her a spirited round of applause from the audience, along with the usual smattering of catcalls. Castle Rock may be proud of its hometown girl made good, but there are still plenty of folks around here who don't believe a woman should be representing their voice in the nation's capital, much less a 37-year-old woman who happens to be a Democrat. That's what many of the old-timers down at the corner store call adding insult to injury. When Bridget originally explained that the plan for everyone inside the municipal center to file outside to Castle Rock Common at 11 p.m. so the big midnight countdown could take place in the center of town by the clock tower, Gwendy believed it was the very epitome of a bad idea. It would be dark and freezing cold. People would be tired and cranky. She predicted that most folks would probably just head for their cars and the warmth of their living rooms at that point to celebrate the ball dropping with Dick Clark and assorted celebrity guests on television. But she was dead wrong, she admitted now. The PTA volunteers had created quite the festive winter wonderland on the common, hanging dozens of strings of twinkling white Christmas lights in the trees and shrubbery, around the railing and the roof of the bandstand, and along the white picket fence that bordered the woods at the northern edge of the common. Red and green streamers hung from lampposts and street signs. A hot chocolate and coffee booth had been set up by the entrance, and someone had even dressed up the war memorial, draping a bright red ribbon around the World War I soldier's neck and scrubbing the splatters of bird shit off his pie-dish helmet. Conspicuous in their absence were the number of "Have you seen this girl?" posters, missing from nearby telephone poles and lampposts, and the windows of the handful of buildings that bordered the common. For a few hours on one night only, talk of the missing girls had been pushed to the background, and folks were focusing on the positive and hopeful. Tomorrow morning, the posters and chatter would undoubtedly return. At 11:45 p.m., as Gwendy stands in line waiting for hot chocolate, the place is positively hopping. Kids dart past her in eager packs, shouting and laughing, tossing snowballs at each other and sliding on stray patches of ice, while their parents and neighbors wander around, flitting from huddled group to huddled group, chatting, gossiping, sneaking sips of whiskey from hidden flasks, and making grandiose plans for 2000 to be the best year ever. Gwendy spots Grace Featherstone from the book nook talking to Nanette from the diner over by the bandstand. Bridget is holding court with a number of her PTA minions by the picnic tables, no doubt making sure everything's set for midnight and the big countdown. Gwendy saw Mr. and Mrs. Hoffman earlier inside the hall, but did her best to avoid them, going so far as to hide in the bathroom for much longer than was probably necessary. So far, so good in that regard. She hasn't seen either one of them again since. The line inches forward, and she notices a tall man with a bushy mustache, wearing a Patriot's cap, leaning against a lamppost by the fountain. He appears to be watching her, but Gwendy can't be sure she isn't imagining it. She thinks she remembers seeing him earlier in the audience during her speech.
"That you, Mrs. Gwendy Peterson?"
She turns around. It takes her a second to recognize the older man standing behind her, but then it comes to her in a flash. "Well, hello again, Mr. Charlie Brown."
"Just Charlie, please."
"Enjoying the New Year's Eve festivities?"
"I was enjoying it a lot more when we were inside and I wasn't freezing my giblets off."
Gwendy tosses her head back and laughs. "Good thing the wind isn't blowing, or we'd look like a bunch of ice sculptures out here." He grunts and looks around. "You see my boy around anywhere? That clock strikes midnight and I'm out of here."
Gwendy shakes her head. "Sorry, I haven't seen him."
"There you are," Bridget says, arriving in a perfume-scented flurry. "I was looking for you. What are you doing waiting in line?"
She waves furiously at one of the women in the booth.
Can I get a hot cocoa ASAP for the congresswoman?
Bridget, no, Gwendy says, horrified. People are staring at them, some of them pointing.
Here you go, a dark-haired woman says, hustling over with a steaming styrofoam cup.
Gwendy doesn't want to accept it, but she has no choice. Thank you. You really didn't have to do that.
Nonsense, Bridget says, taking her by the arm and leading her away. I want you to sit right next to me at midnight.
Happy New Year, Mr. Brown, Gwendy says over her shoulder. It was nice seeing you again.
Happy New Year, Congresswoman, he says, smirking.
And Gwendy doesn't know if it's her imagination or not, but she's almost positive his tone is no longer a friendly one.
3 more minutes, Bridget says, glancing at her watch.
She spots her husband standing across the common, talking to 2 other men.
Travis! Travis!
She points at the clock tower. Over there! He nods dutifully and starts in that direction. The miniature clock tower is located at the very heart of the Castle Rock Common. It stands 22 feet high, and its face measures 3 feet across its center. Erected during the town's reconstruction period, in the aftermath of the Big Fire, there's an engraved metal plaque positioned at the stone base of the tower that reads, "In honor of the indomitable spirit of the citizens of Castle Rock, 1992. A burly woman wearing what looks like several layers of flannel shirts flashes a look of relief as they approach.
Thank goodness, I was starting to get worried.
She hands Bridget a microphone. A long black cord snakes from the bottom of the mic to a large speaker propped up on a picnic table behind them. Gwendy smiles at the woman. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year,
she says shyly and quickly looks away. Travis walks up beside them, grinning and smelling like aftershave and whiskey.
All ready to go, ladies?
Almost, Bridget says.
She turns on the microphone, and a whine of feedback erupts from the speaker. People groan and cover their ears. The woman in the flannel shirt scurries to adjust several knobs at the top of the speaker until the sound diminishes and finally dissipates.
1 minute till midnight, Bridget announces giddily. 1 minute until midnight.
A crowd starts to gather at the foot of the clock tower, the younger kids swarming toward the front, most of them wearing glow-in-the-dark necklaces and carrying party horns or noisemakers. Most of the adults are wearing glittery cardboard hats with Y2K or 2000 or Happy New Year printed across the brims at jaunty angles.
30 seconds!
Bridget shouts, her tone bordering on hysterical. And for the first time tonight, Gwendy wonders how much her friend has had to drink. Studying the crowd, she sees Grace and Nanette and Millie Harris, the church organist, huddled together off to the side. All 3 are staring up at the clock and counting down. Charlie Brown is standing toward the back by himself, with his foot propped up on a bench. He's wearing scuffed cowboy boots and a green plastic derby with a fake yellow flower poking out from the top. He grins and gives Gwendy a big wave. She gratefully waves back, thinking she must have been wrong about him before. Maybe 10 yards behind Mr. Brown is the mustached stranger in the Patriot's cap. He's scanning the crowd, but it's hard to get a good look at his face because the brim of his hat is tilted so low.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
Bridget lowers the microphone from her mouth. The roar of the crowd has grown louder than her amplified voice. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The crowd erupts.
Happy New Year!
A cacophony of drunken hooting and hollering, blowing horns and honking noisemakers fill the air. Confetti is tossed by the handfuls. Someone on the other side of the common shoots off a string of bottle rockets. Brilliant explosions of red, white, and blue sparks light up the night sky and shower down upon the snow-covered ground. Everywhere around Gwendy, people are embracing and kissing. She thinks of Ryan, the way his whiskers tickle her chin when he kisses her, and a deep ache blooms in the center of her chest. Bridget untangles herself from her husband's arms, and then it's Gwendy's turn.
Happy New Year! She shouts above the clatter, hugging Gwendy tight. I'm so glad you're here.
Happy New Year, Gwendy says, her face awash in the glow of fireworks.
My turn next,
Travis is standing behind his wife, arms held open wide, looking at Gwendy.
Happy New Year!
Gwendy leans over and hugs him, and the side of her face brushes against the cold skin of Travis's cheek.
Happy New...
she starts to say, and then something changes. Everything changes. Suddenly, Travis appears very clear to her, very bright and in focus, almost as if he's somehow lit from within, and everything else around him falls away. She notices the tiny scar on Travis's chin and immediately understands that the neighbor's dog Barney snapped at Travis when he was 8 years old because he'd been throwing rocks at it from across the chain-link fence. This was in Boston where Travis grew up. She stares at the thick, wavy texture of his hair and suddenly understands that he's having an affair with his hairdresser, a single woman named Katie, who lives in a trailer on the outskirts of town with her 3-year-old son. Her dear old friend Bridget knows nothing about it. And then Gwendy's vision blurs, and Travis suddenly swirls out of view, like he's being sucked into the maw of a pitch-black vortex, and everything else around him swims back into focus.
You okay?
Travis asks. He's standing a few feet away, staring at her with concern in his eyes. Gwendy blinks and looks around.
I'm fine, she says. Felt a little lightheaded for a minute there.
Christ, I thought you were having a seizure or something, he says.
Come on, Bridget says, taking her by the arm. Let's sit down.
Honest, I'm fine. She wants out of there, and she wants out of there right now. I think it's time I head home. It's been a long day.
Are you sure you should be driving? Travis could take...
I'm good, Wendy says, forcing a smile. I promise. Bridget gives her a lingering look.
Okay. But please be careful.
Will do, Gwendy says, waving goodbye. I'll talk to you tomorrow. What in the hell was that all about? She thinks, cutting across the common on the way to her car. She doesn't even know how to describe what just happened, but she knows she's never experienced anything remotely like it before. It's almost as if a door had opened and she'd stepped inside. But opened to what? Travis's soul? It sounded hokey, like something out of a science fiction novel. But it also made a certain amount of sense to her, the same way that the button box made a certain amount of sense to her now. Was what happened some kind of a bizarre side effect because of the chocolates she'd given to her mom? And why Travis? She barely knew the guy, and he certainly wasn't the only person she'd come in contact with tonight. She shook hands with dozens of other people. A dark figure suddenly steps out of the shadows in front of her. Are you okay, Mrs. Peterson? Startled, Gwendy jerks to a stop. It's the stranger in the Patriot's cap, and he's standing close enough to reach out and touch her. She's trapped in between buildings now, and it's darker here without the streetlights.
I'm fine, she says, trying to sound unafraid. You really should be more careful about ambushing people like that, especially with everything that's going on around here.
I apologize, the man says in a pleasant tone. I saw what happened and was concerned.
You saw what happened? Gwendy repeats with an edge to her voice. And why were you watching me in the first place, Mr.
Nolan, the man says, pulling open his coat to reveal a badge clipped to his belt. Detective Nolan. Gwendy's eyes widen, and she feels a flush spread across her cheeks.
And now I feel very foolish.
The detective holds up his hands.
Please don't, ma'am. I should have identified myself right away.
Did Sheriff Ridgwick ask you to keep an eye on me?
No, ma'am, he says. Way he talks about you, I'm pretty sure the sheriff thinks you can take care of yourself.
Gwendy laughs. She can picture Norris saying exactly those words.
Well, have a good night, detective. Thanks for checking on me.
He nods mutely and starts walking back in the direction of the common. Gwendy turns toward the street, and in the time it takes to recognize the man walking toward her, she decides to conduct an experiment.
Hey there, Mr. Gallagher, she says. Happy New Year.
She tugs the glove off her right hand and extends it toward him.
Happy New Year to you too, young lady.
Gwendy's eighth grade algebra teacher shakes her hand with a firm grip. She can feel the rough calluses on his palm.
You should stop by the school one day. The kids would love to see you.
I'll do that, she says, waiting for something, anything, out of the ordinary to happen. But it doesn't. So she keeps walking until she reaches Main Street, where she parked her car. She's thinking about the button box and its chocolate treats and not looking where she's going, when her feet suddenly go out from under her. One minute she's striding confidently past the Castle Rock Diner, catching a fleeting glimpse of her reflection in the darkened front window, and the next, she's skidding across an icy patch of sidewalk, her arms flailing above her head. Someone grabs her around the waist. "Oh my God," she says, steadying herself. "That was a close one, Mrs. Peterson." Lucas Brown lets go of her waist and reaches down to the sidewalk. He comes back up holding her glove. "You dropped this?" He smiles and hands it to her, and their bare fingers touch. And Main Street suddenly falls away, the cars and storefronts and streetlights disappearing. And all she can see is him in brilliant, almost luminescent detail. And just like that, she knows. Lucas Brown is the Tooth Fairy. She stares at his hand and watches as his gloved fingers wrap around a stainless steel instrument, reach into a dummy mouth full of fake teeth set up on a brightly lit table. UB School of Dental Medicine stitched across the breast of the long white lab coat he's wearing. And then those same fingers, filthy now, gripping a pair of rusty workroom pliers, and he's standing over a cowering Deborah Parker, her long hair spiked with sweat, her eyes wide and frightened, the tips of his cowboy boots splattered with fat drops of blood. And then the darkness swallows him away, and the streetscape sharpens into focus again, and Lucas Brown is standing on the sidewalk in front of her. "What just happened?" he asks, eyes narrowing. "Are you okay?"
I'm fine," she says. "Thank you. You saved me from a nasty fall."
Her voice sounds dull and distant. A young couple walking arm in arm passes by then. The teenage boy, a James Dean wannabe with his leather jacket and cigarette dangling from his mouth, nods at them. "What's up, Lucas?" Lucas doesn't answer, doesn't even look at the guy, just watches Gwendy cross the street with that same wary look on his face. Gwendy unlocks the car and climbs inside, hurriedly locking the door behind her. Her hands are shaking, and her heart feels like it's going to burst inside her chest. She starts the engine and pulls away without letting it warm up. When she glances toward the sidewalk, Lucas Brown is still standing there, watching her. '68. Sheriff Ridgwick picks up on the first ring. "Hello?" "It's Lucas Brown," Gwendy nearly shouts. "Lucas Brown's the Tooth Fairy."
"Gwendy, do you know what time it is?"
"Listen to me, Norris, please. I think Deborah Parker's still alive, but I don't know how much time she has."
"Okay, start over and tell me how you know this."
"I just ran into Lucas Brown on Main Street and..."
"What were you doing on Main Street at this time of night?"
"I was walking to my car after the New Year's Eve party," she says, her frustration building. "But that's not important. Lucas Brown went to dental school in Buffalo."
"How exactly do you know that?
For that matter, how do you know Lucas Brown?"
"I met him and his father when we were searching the field that day. His father told me Lucas went to college in Buffalo, but he came home early after he got into some kind of trouble." "And Lucas told you it was dental school when you saw him tonight?"
She doesn't answer right away.
"Something like that." She takes a deep breath.
"Norris, he was wearing cowboy boots. I think there was blood on them." Rustling in the background now.
"Where are you?"
"I just turned on 117, headed home."
"Turn around," he says,
and she can hear a door opening and closing.
"Meet me at the station. Don't call anyone else."
"Hurry, Norris." 69. Gwendy pulls up a chair and sits next to Sheila Brigham inside the dispatch cubicle, listening to the radio calls as they come in. She recognizes Sheriff Ridgwick right away, although his voice sounds much deeper over the airwaves, and State Trooper Tom Knoll, who was a year behind her at Castle Rock High and grew up two blocks away from Carbine Street. The others are strangers to her, their words terse and clipped, but Gwendy can hear the excitement simmering in their voices. The sheriff and deputy footman are in the lead car, followed by a large convoy of Castle County Sheriff's Department, Castle Rock Police Department, and Maine State Police vehicles. They've just crossed over the old railroad bridge on Jessup Road and will be splitting up and surrounding the Browns Ranch House in a matter of minutes. Despite numerous requests and a half-hearted attempt at bribery involving one of Mr. Peterson's prized fly fishing rods, the sheriff refused to allow Gwendy to ride along with him or his men. The press would have a field day, he argued, especially if something went wrong and she were injured. So this is the closest she'll get to the action. She stares at the radio with nervous anticipation, tapping her foot on the ugly green carpet and chewing her fingernails. Sheila has already scolded her twice for not being able to sit still, but Gwendy can't help it. She's running on fumes and nearly a half dozen cups of coffee. It's almost 10 o'clock in the morning and she hasn't slept a wink. In fact, she didn't even make it home last night. Shortly after 1 a.m., not long after meeting Gwendy at the station house, Sheriff Ridgwick got in touch with a Detective Tipton of the Buffalo Police Department. Files were pulled, phone calls were made, doors knocked on. By 6 a.m., a senior official from the admissions office at the University of Buffalo verified that Lucas Tillman Brown of Castle Rock, Maine, was dismissed from the School of Dental Medicine just before the conclusion of his third semester, after numerous female students filed sexual harassment and stalking complaints against him. Shortly after 8 a.m., state police detectives learned from the Tomlinsons and the Parkers that both families had hired handyman Charles Brown the previous spring to power wash the aluminum siding on their houses. In both instances, Mr. Brown had been accompanied by his son. It'd been so long ago the families had simply forgotten. This treasure trove of new information led to a search warrant being issued for the Brown residence and the surrounding property.
"I've got my eyes on a single male subject," the radio squawks, and Gwendy can picture Sheriff Ridgwick sitting in the driver's seat of his cruiser squinting through a dirty windshield. "Check that. Two male subjects in the garage. Second man's working under the truck."
"Copy that. We're in position out back."
"All good at the fence line. He comes this way, we got him."
"Approaching subjects now. Detective Tomes at my 12 o'clock blocking the driveway. Stand by."
3.5 minutes later.
"Warrant has been served. Both subjects cooperating. Detectives entering the residence. Stand by."
The radio mostly goes silent then. Someone requests a new pair of gloves be brought inside the house. Another officer asks if he and his men should continue to turn away traffic at the intersection. Deputy Portman responds in the affirmative. Gwendy pulls in a deep breath, lets it out. Sheila takes a bite of her donut and stares intently at the radio monitor, the expression on her face unchanged.
"How in the world are you so calm?" Gwendy asks, breaking the silence. "I'm dying over here."
Sheila gives her a dry look, smudges of white powder stuck in the corners of her mouth.
25 years on the job, honey. Seen and heard it all by now. You wouldn't believe the things I've seen."
She takes another bite of donut and continues with her mouthful.
"I'll tell you this, though. If you don't stop chewing on those nails of yours, you're going to have to walk across the street to the drugstore in about 5 minutes and buy yourself some Band-Aids."
Gwendy lowers her pinky finger from her mouth and crosses her arms like a sullen teenager.
"Sheila, come back," the radio squawks.
She wipes powdery fingers on her blouse and keys the mic.
"Right here, Sheriff."
There's a crackle of static and then,
"I've got a message for our visitor."
"Roger that. She's sitting right next to me, gnawing on her fingers."
"Tell her. We got our man."
Seventy.
"Turn it up, Gwen,"
her father says, sitting down on the arm of his recliner. He's staring at the television screen with rapt fascination.
"I'll be making a few brief comments," Sheriff Ridgwick says into the tangle of microphones set up outside the station house. "And then I'll hand it over to State Police Detective Frank Tome to answer any questions."
He flips open a notepad and starts reading.
"Earlier today, the Castle County Sheriff's Department and the Maine State Police executed a search warrant at a residence located at 113 Ford Road in northern Castle Rock.
A number of personal items belonging to Rhonda Tomlinson were discovered under a loose floorboard in one of the bedrooms. After interviewing multiple residents of the home, a suspect, Lucas Brown, age 20, was placed into custody. After receiving permission from the owner of the residence, Charles Brown, age 59, to search a family-owned cabin located near Dark Score Lake, officers discovered 14-year-old Deborah Parker shackled and unconscious inside the cabin's dirt cellar. She has been reunited with her family and is currently receiving medical treatment at a local hospital. The sheriff looks up from his notepad, the dark circles under his eyes telling the rest of the story. After an extensive search of the property surrounding the cabin, officers were able to locate the remains of Rhonda Tomlinson and Carla Hoffman buried a short distance away. Both families have been notified, and the victim's remains will be transported to the Castle County Morgue in due course pending further investigation. Lucas Brown has been charged in the abductions and murders of Ms. Tomlinson and Ms. Hoffman and the abduction and torture of Ms. Parker. Additional charges are pending. Lucas Brown remains in custody at this time at the Castle County Sheriff's Department. Detective Tome will now take your questions. Sheriff Ridgwick steps away from the makeshift podium and stares at the ground. Well, Mr. Peterson sighs. Far from a happy ending, but it's the best we could have hoped for, I suppose. Those poor families, Mrs. Peterson says, making the sign of the cross. I can't even imagine what they're going through. Gwendy doesn't say anything. The last 18 hours have been a whirlwind, and her brain and body are still struggling to recover. Earlier in the afternoon, the sheriff confided in her with great detail the horrors they'd discovered inside the Browns' house and cabin. A pair of Ziploc sandwich baggies, found under a second loose floorboard in Lucas's bedroom, the first containing assorted jewelry belonging to Lord knows how many women, and the second baggie containing 57 teeth of various shapes and sizes. In the cellar of the cabin, they found a macabre toolkit consisting of a selection of blood-stained pliers, an electric drill, and several power saws. Gwendy wondered how long it would take for the press to get hold of this information. Good for Norris Ridgwick, Mr. Peterson says, still staring at the television. About time the people in this town gave him his due. Gwendy's cell phone rings. I better take this. She gets up from the sofa and walks into the kitchen. Hello?
Got a minute?
Were your ears burning, Sheriff?
Every day for the last 2 weeks, he says wearily.
We just watched a replay of your press conference. You did well.
Thanks.
He pauses.
I still feel strange not mentioning your part in the investigation. Feels wrong to get all the credit.
I figure a lot of that credit is overdue around here.
I wouldn't say that.
I would.
I do have one question for you.
Here it comes. What's that? She asks.
I know the whole dental school thing tipped it off for you, and the cowboy boots. But how did you really know?
Gwendy doesn't answer right away. When she does, her words are carefully chosen, and as honest as she can make them.
It was just a strong feeling.
He gave off this seriously creepy vibe, a kind of hunger. You could feel it wafting off him.
So you're saying it was gut instinct?
She can picture him rolling his eyes.
Something like that. Well, whatever it was, I'm grateful. You saved that girl's life.
We did, Norris.
Are you home right now? I want to drop off the report I just finished writing. Make sure we're on the same page.
I'm at my parents' house, but I could swing by the station after dinner.
That'll be too late. You mind if I bring it by there?
That's fine, I'll be here. And she thinks, if he tries to shake my hand, I'll just tell him I'm coming down with a bug. Better not to touch me. Just like I told my parents earlier this afternoon.
Great, give me 15 minutes.
But it only takes 10. Gwendy is leaning across the dining room table, looking for a corner piece of the latest jigsaw puzzle, the nighttime skyline of New York City, when the doorbell rings. That's Norris, she says, getting up from the table.
Make sure you invite him in, Mrs. Peterson says. Gwendy walks into the foyer. You must have been speeding, she says, swinging the door open. The words die in her throat. Ryan? Her husband is standing on the porch, a bouquet of flowers in one hand, his camera bag in the other. His face is clean-shaven and tanned. His eyes are twinkling with nervous anticipation. He looks like a little boy bouncing on his heels and grinning. I know how you like surprises, he says. Gwendy squeals with excitement and throws herself into his arms. He drops the camera bag and picks her up with his free hand spinning her around. Her lips find his, and as he twirls her around and around on the porch of the house she grew up in, she thinks, there's nothing bad in this man, only home. For the first time in her life, Gwendy wants to tell someone about the button box. She glances over at Ryan in the driver's seat. She hates keeping such a big secret from him, any secret for that matter. But she worries that it could be dangerous for her husband to know about the box. She also doesn't like the idea of him not having a choice in the matter. If she decides to tell him, he's stuck with the knowledge and the responsibility, whether he wants it or not. How is that any better than what Richard Ferris has done to her? Twice now. Penny for your thoughts, he says, checking his rearview mirror and signaling to change lanes. You're awfully quiet. Worried about the emergency session? She nods her head. Yes, and it's the truth. You'll do great, honey. I honestly don't even know what I'm supposed to do, what my role in all of this will be. You'll listen and learn, and then you'll step up and lead. It's what you always do. She sighs and stares out the window. Frozen ponds and farm buildings, snow swirled into gray ghosts, blur past in the distant fields. Hopefully we can talk some sense into the man, but I'm not holding my breath. If I know you, you won't rest until you do. The call came in the night before. On the other end of the line was the Speaker of the House himself, Dennis Hastert. His message was brief and to the point. Both the House and Senate would reconvene on Monday, January 3rd, at 9 a.m., 5 days ahead of schedule. Gwendy thanked him for the call and hung up and then told Ryan. They'd only left her parents' house a couple of hours earlier, and he hadn't even had time to unpack his bags yet. She was afraid to leave the button box inside the safe at the condo. What if Ryan decided to go home without her at some point and he opened it? And Castle Rock Savings and Loan was closed because it was Sunday, so she had no choice but to take the box along with her. As soon as that problem was solved, another complication rose in its place. Because of the short notice, she was unable to arrange for a private plane out of Castle County Airport and was forced to fly out of a larger commuter airpark just south of Portland. But the extra drive and the inevitable questions from Ryan, since when do we fly private, were worth the hassle if only to avoid the X-ray machines at the airport. How about I drop you out front with the luggage? Ryan asks, steering the car off the exit ramp and onto the access road for Portland South Air Park. I'll go park in the garage and meet you inside. Sounds good. We should have plenty of time. Ryan pulls up to the section of curb marked unloading zone in front of the main building. Unlike the Castle County Airport, this place actually has more than one, not to mention multiple runways and a three-story parking garage, and unloads the luggage from the trunk, including Gwendy's carry-on containing the button box. He leaves Gwendy standing at the curb and drives across the street to the garage. She looks around and sees two large families waiting in line with their suitcases at baggage check, in this case a makeshift fiberglass booth with a pair of oversized grocery carts parked beside it. Several young children are doing their best to squirm out of their parents' grip, and one little girl, her face beet red and stained with tears, appears on the verge of a major tantrum. A lone, harried-looking airport employee is ticketing the mountain of expensive luggage with the efficiency and speed of a sloth. If he has any help on this second day of January, it's currently nowhere in sight. Gwendy sighs, feeling sorry for the guy, and sits down on a nearby bench. She arranges the three large suitcases in front of her on the sidewalk and places her carry-on next to her, resting an arm atop it for safekeeping. Excuse me, madam. Is anyone sitting here? Not at all, she says, looking up. Feel free to... Richard Ferris is standing in front of her, looking almost like a mirror image of the man she'd first met 25 years earlier on a bench in Castleview Park. His face hasn't aged a day, and he's wearing dark jeans with a button-down dress shirt, light gray this time instead of white, a dark jacket as if from a suit, and of course, that small, neat black hat of his is perched atop his head. Where did you come from? She says in a low, awed voice. He sits down at the other end of the bench, smiling warmly. The carry-on suitcase rests between them. Gwendy thinks about pinching herself on the arm to make sure she's not dreaming, but she's suddenly afraid to move. Was that you at the mall with my mom? Why did you leave the box with me again? She's speaking fast now, weeks of frustration and anxiety surging in her voice. I thought you said... Ferris holds up a hand, silencing her. I understand you have questions, but my time here is limited, so let us palaver for a spell before we're interrupted. He scoots a little closer to the center of the bench. Regarding the return of our old friend, the button box, let's just say I found myself in a bit of a jam and needed to tuck it away somewhere safe for a short time. He looks at her with discernible affection in his light blue eyes. You, Gwendy Peterson, were the safest place I could think of. I guess I'll take that as a compliment. As it was intended, dear girl. I told you long ago, your proprietorship of the button box was exceptional the first time I left it in your possession, and I have full trust it was once again. I wouldn't be so sure, she says. I was a mess the whole time. I didn't know what to do. Push the button, not push the button. She lets out a long breath. In the end, I did the best I could. And that's all anyone can ask for in such an endeavor. Knowing you as I do, I believe you did quite well this time around, too. He rests his hand on the carry-on suitcase, drumming his long, slender fingers along the zipper. Ignoring the temptation of the buttons is a difficult chore during the best of times. Not many are able to resist. But as you well know by now, when left alone, the box can be a strong force for good. But I didn't leave it alone, she says with a whine in her voice she remembers well from adolescence. Not completely. I pulled the lever. A lot. Ferris nods his head ever so slightly. Will my mother be okay? The chocolates cured her, didn't they? And then almost as an afterthought, I had to try. Hospitals have been known to make mistakes, particularly when it comes to those pesky blood tests. Samples get contaminated. Glass tubes get mislabeled. Happens all the time. I trust you left her with a sufficient supply? I did, she says, sounding like a guilty teenager. A minivan pulls to the curb in front of them. The side door slides open, and a woman and a young girl climb out carrying suitcases. They both say cheerful goodbyes to the driver. The door slides shut and the van drives away. The woman and girl walk to the back of the line at baggage check and never once glance in their direction on the bench. What happened with Lucas Brown and my friend's husband? The awful things I saw in my head? The box did that, right? Was it because of the chocolates? Will it happen again? That's not up to me. When it comes to the button box, some things, many things, remain beyond my reach. She gapes at him. But if you don't know the answers, then who does? Ferris doesn't respond, just studies her through squinting eyes that appear almost gray now. The hat lays a thin line of shadow over his brow. Finally, he says, I do, however, have one resolution for you that I believe you've been anxious about for quite some time now. What? Gwendy asks, and the whiny tone is back. The idea that Richard Ferris is not, in fact, the omnipotent force behind the button box's power, but rather some kind of glorified courier, not only pisses Gwendy off, but also terrifies her. He leans closer, and for one tense moment, Gwendy fears he's going to reach out and take her hand. Your life is indeed your own. The stories you've chosen to tell, the people you've chosen to fight for, the lives you've touched. He waves his hand through the air in front of his face. All your own doing. not the button boxes. You have always been special, Gwendy Peterson, from the day you were born. Gwendy forgets to breathe for a moment. She feels an enormous weight crumble from atop her shoulders, from around her heart.
Thank you,
she manages, voice trembling. Ferris cocks his head as if listening to a faraway voice.
Alas, my time is up. Your husband is on his way. Lovely man he is, too. A storyteller in his own right.
What about the box? Gwendy blurts.
Already taken care of.
She looks at him momentarily confused, and then she picks up her carry-on bag and gives it a shake. It feels empty. It is empty.
How did you?
Ferris laughs. You should know better by now than to ask such silly questions, young lady. Feels strange to be called young lady by a man who appears to be roughly the same age as she. Then again, every minute of this experience feels strange, almost dreamlike. I must go, he says, standing. And Gwendy's certain he's going to take out his old-fashioned watch from the pocket inside his coat and check the time, but he doesn't. Although I slowed his progress quite a bit. Your husband's a dedicated man, and he'll be here shortly. He looks down at Gwendy with that same glimmer of affection shining in his eyes. And then the two of you shall check your bags and soar up and away into a long and prosperous and happy life together.
If we ever make it through that line, Gwendy says jokingly.
What line? He asks. She looks up and points. That one. But now there's no one waiting in front of the baggage check booth. Not a single person.
What the?
When she turns back to the bench, Richard Ferris is gone. She gets to her feet and looks around, but he's nowhere in sight. The sidewalk and road are empty. He just vanished into thin air, but not before leaving a goodbye present for her. Sitting on top of Gwendy's carry-on bag is a very familiar, small, white feather. 72.
All set,
Ryan says, jogging across the street. They pick up their suitcases and head down the sidewalk toward baggage check.
What took you so long? Gwendy asks.
Elevator was out of order, had to walk down 3 floors, then I realized I forgot to lock the damn car, so I had to walk all the way back up again.
Gwendy laughs. My little worrywart.
Learned it from you, he says, sticking his tongue out at her.
She puts a hand on his arm, stopping him, suddenly serious. I was thinking about what you said, in the car. He gives her a questioning look. You were right, she says. When I get there tomorrow, I'll listen and learn, and then I'll do the work. Whatever it takes, however long it takes. He leans close, so their foreheads are touching. Now that sounds like the Gwendy Peterson I know.
How may I help you folks? The smiling man sitting inside the booth asks.
We're on flight 117, Ryan says, checking the paperwork. Scheduled to take off at 3:10. We'd like to check 3 bags, please.
The man picks up a clipboard and scribbles something on a sheet of paper.
Can I see your IDs, please?
Ryan pulls out his wallet and shows the man his driver's license. Gwendy fishes out her license out the side pocket of her purse and slides it across the counter. The man picks it up, double-checks the name, and then hands it back to her.
That'll do it, he says.
He walks out from behind the booth and places their bags into one of the oversized carts. Unclipping a walkie-talkie from his belt, he keys the button and says, Flight 117, baggage pickup. Come and get him, Johnny. A muffled voice answers,
Copy that, boss. Be there in a flash.
Gwendy and Ryan start walking up the sidewalk toward the main building. But Gwendy turns back after a couple of steps and returns to the luggage cart. She throws her empty carry-on bag in with the others. Then she reaches into her coat pocket. Here you go, sir. Happy New Year. She tosses something to the man inside the booth. He reaches up and snags it. Staring down at the shiny silver coin, lying heads up in his palm, his face brightens.
Hey now. Thank you very kindly, ma'am.
Gwendy laughs. She turns around and takes Ryan's hand, and they walk into the airport together.
Gwendy's Magic Feather, a novella, was written by Richard Chismar and read by Maggie Siff. It was recorded by Michael Bognar at CDM Studios in New York. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. Gwendy's Magic Feather was produced and directed by Tiffany Ferrari. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Gwendy's Magic Feather, a novella, is available in print from Gallery Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Gwendy's Button Box, a novella, written by Stephen King and Richard Chismar, and read by Maggie Siff.